Blog Talk Radio.
How's it going, everybody? Chris Block here, Puck Chatter Radio, here on blogtalkradio.com, also thethirdmanin.com, puckchatter.com, here on this Monday night, April the 30th, 2012, 7 o'clock here in Chicago. Here to talk about the Blackhawks, maybe a surprise to some, eliminated the first round by those Phoenix Coyotes, the red-hot Phoenix Coyotes, smashing the Nashville Predators this past week. Up 2-0 in that series as they head back to Nashville. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, but mostly we just want to talk about, focus on the Blackhawks, what happened, and what's going to need to happen moving forward for this not to happen again. Second straight year, the Blackhawks eliminated in the first round, and not particularly good showings in either one. To help us do that, frequent guest, he was on the last time we did a show, from MyFoxChicago.com, also SiriusXM Radio, and HockeyIndependent.com has still got his stuff over there. Al Samaglia, how you doing, Al?
Hey, Chris, doing good.
Before we get going, I want to, because I will forget, before we get going, next week on the show, next Tuesday, May 8th, Sam Fells, the committed Indian, SecondCityHockey.com, we'll be talking more Blackhawk stuff, and maybe even we'll get Sam to talk about what it's like to deal with all that hate mail that he gets after he prints one of my columns in the Indian. But so that's next week for those looking ahead. Al, I guess first of all, before we get into it, were you? I mean, I think I know the answer to this question. You surprised that, you know, going into the playoffs, a lot was talked about matchups, and a lot of people had their opinions about what the favorable matchup was, the best team that was out there for the Blackhawks to play, and many people, I would say 7, 8 out of 10, would have told you the Phoenix Coyotes. Well, you know, Blackhawks ousted in 6. Were you surprised the Blackhawks had as much, as you know, problem with Phoenix as they turned out to, as they did?
You know, you really can't be surprised at much of anything this year. I do have to admit that I thought there was really no excuse for losing the Coyotes. I mean, Mike Smith was all world and everything else, but the way this team is supposed to be constructed, they're supposed to be able to find ways to score 5-on-5, and really, you know, for the first part of the series, they did their best work when the goalie was on the bench and they came back to tie scores. You know, if you look at it and take a step back, I think beside Phoenix, maybe San Jose would have been as good of a matchup for the Hawks, because I like the way the Hawks play against San Jose. But I think in a lot of ways, playing a team with a power play almost as bad as the Hawks, this was the opportunity, you know. And maybe it says more about actually where the Hawks rank in the scheme of things rather than anything else.
I want to talk about, you know, I don't think we're going to get too much into free agency and things like that. I know people are already starting to talk about players the Blackhawks should target. I think everyone needs to understand that there is no CBA in place, and that is going to severely hamper teams that, you know, spend to the cap every single season once we get to July 1st. I don't know how much activity there's going to be on July 1 unless you're a team that's miles below the current CBA and have money to burn. I don't know what teams like Philadelphia and Chicago are going to be able to do. But I don't want to get into that, because I think it's almost irrelevant when you don't know what the stakes are, what the score is. But I do want to get into the fallout of the season and what we heard Joe Quenneville, Stan Bowman, the players talk about after the season was over, because when trying to evaluate, you can't just do it on your own. You have to take into account what's coming out of the camp there. And I want to focus, first of all, on Stan Bowman, because, you know, you and I will talk a lot about players, and we have in the past, and we will tonight, but Stan Bowman is the guy that's going to make these decisions. And I thought the most striking thing that came out of the postseason presser was basically Stan Bowman, when asked about what went wrong and the improvements that need to be made, Stan Bowman did not talk about personnel, except for, with the exception of Corey Crawford. Now, we know that Stan Bowman jumped the gun and went ahead and re-signed Ray Emery. So you would figure then that he's got his backup goalie in place, and he's talked specifically about Corey Crawford needing to be better. And secondarily, and maybe even a priority above that, that could be argued, was Stan Bowman really put the emphasis on the special teams. And his quote when talking about the power play and special teams, he said, this is Stan Bowman's quote, "The results speak for themselves. They were a huge disappointment this year." And then he continued on, and this is his quote, "It's more of a coaching thing than anything." So this is Stan Bowman saying, okay, we lost in the first round, but we need Corey Crawford to be better, and I need my coaching staff to do a better job, and kind of absolving himself, maybe you disagree with this, Al, but Stan Bowman kind of absolving himself of there's anything that, substantial that he needs to do to fix this. Did you agree?
Well, yeah, the finger was pointed at everybody but Stan Bowman. Interestingly enough, and then on the opposite end, and we'll talk about that later, I would think, is Joel Quenneville pointed at the players. So I walked away pretty confused. In my view, I have to beat it like a dead horse, and I have for months. It was an overvalued roster from the beginning of the year, and there were some swings and misses that happened in the summer. And, if it's not on the players or the coaching, then if it's not on the coaching, then it has to be on the players, which leaves the door open for criticism that maybe it was a bad mix of players or maybe it was an overvalued roster. Now, if you go to, we'll go into Quenneville a little bit because it kind of blends in with what I'm saying. For whatever reason, then on the back end of it all, Quenneville brings up about team chemistry. I don't know, I thought everything was sunshine and lollipops. I haven't heard anything behind the scenes as far as, disgruntled groups of players or anything like that. And, heard a little bit that people weren't happy when John Scott was traded, but, the stories went off the website quickly and he was quickly forgotten just as quick as that. So I don't know why the chemistry part was brought up, which kind of points to a mixed-matched group of players, which would be on Stan Bowman. Simply put, until proven otherwise, I'm sure Joel Quenneville had some input on some of the summer signings. With his resume, his pedigree as a head coach, he has input. Stan Bowman has to take the fall for the signings, though, if they don't work out, because that's on him. He constructs the roster. So we had a little bit of finger-pointing there. And at the end of the day, there was talk of chemistry and players taking things for granted and everything else. And I left a little bit confused and, to be honest with you, with not a good outlook as to what's going to happen this summer unless they get on the same page and develop a plan here. Because right now, it didn't appear that they know which direction to go in.
Yeah, and again, we're going to talk about sort of holes in the roster, what's going to be left over, who we expect to be gone. Question I have for you, Jamal Mayers. I think a lot of people were pretty shocked in the playoffs and kind of left mystified why all of a sudden Jamal Mayers became a healthy scratch, and it was something that Joel Quenneville was asked about, and he said that it was very hard for him to go to Jamal Mayers, and Jamal Mayers wasn't happy. That, I'm taking you out of the lineup and I'm playing Brendan Morrison, who couldn't get out of his own way in the games that he got in after coming over in the trade. I'm going to play Brendan Morrison ahead of you. I'm going to play Jimmy Hayes ahead of you. I'm going to play Michael Frolik before Michael Frolik turned into playoff Michael Frolik ahead of you. Was there anything that you've heard or any indication of why that happened, Jamal Mayers being scratched?
No. I haven't heard... Haven't heard a good story to repeat on that at all. Quenneville was scrambling, no doubt. He was looking for something. All I could say is this, and Mayers didn't stick out in the playoff games that he played. He didn't stick out in a bad way either. Maybe, when they looked at tape, he looked run down. I'm just trying to find a reason I don't know. It's not me saying that. You know, I thought it was kind of a mistake to keep using him at center. You know, once again, though, it goes back to a misconstructed roster. You know, there was a reason that Jamal Mayers never played on the power play until this year, really, when he had opportunity here. And, you know, at his age, should he really be playing center? I don't think so. So I don't know. The only thing I could think of is that maybe he didn't have the jump they were looking for. He wanted to shuffle the deck and try something different. I don't have a clue as to any other reason beside that.
Yeah, you know, and I agree. And we talked about it during the season. It was Jamal Mayers at center. Yeah, you can get away with it for a little bit, but you know, up and down the Blackhawks roster, they ask their centers to play 200 feet, and a lot of teams do now. But the Blackhawks, you know, specifically, your center has to play 200 feet. And yeah, Jamal Mayers was a good faceoff man, at least. You know, a lot better than the other options that they had, Marcus Kruger, these other guys. But it was a lot to ask of an aging veteran who's really never played center consistently. He did a little bit in San Jose. He took draws in San Jose and then moved over to the wing. I thought that would be, you know, kind of, you know, his best, you know, the best case scenario, the best situation for him. I wasn't appalled or taken aback at all when he was taken out of the lineup mid-series, but I did think that I was certain of it, just thinking to myself that what you talked about, maybe he lacked that jump. But when you kind of, I would think that Jamal Mayers would take it as an embarrassment, as a slight to take him out of the lineup for a couple of games. I thought for sure they'd go back to him in game six, that would have been motivation. He would have that extra jump. And a veteran like that, you could have used that in that game instead of Jimmy Hayes, you know, who's kind of, really doesn't belong at this point. But so I was surprised, and I was just wondering if, you know, if you had heard anything on that, because it was just kind of in another of those long lines of just confusing roster moves that Quenneville has made.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he was going to come back in the lineup too for the last game. You know, and that happens at times where they take a player out for a game or two and then insert him back in, and especially with a veteran. But I have no clue as to what another reason was. Now, you know, I think if you would have asked most fans 2 months ago, the one player that they would have wanted back from, you know, last summer's crew of signings was Mayers. I mean, maybe Emery too. But so now, you know, you wonder if he really wants to come back. I don't know what kind of opportunities he'll have, but it was a season full of head scratchers. I mean, it really was.
Andrew Burnett, of course, who came in on the one-year deal, basically replaced Troy Brower, who was traded to Washington for the pick that became Philip Deneau, which is an excellent pick. But in the you know, we really saw this year. I never thought, and I think you agree with me. I never thought from the very beginning that Andrew Burnett fit. It just wasn't a guy that I thought maybe 3 or 4 years ago Andrew Burnett would fit in perfectly. But a 38-year-old guy who doesn't get around well at all, didn't really seem to fit in what the Blackhawks do. He's not a guy that stands in front of the net. He's a guy that likes to work pucks behind and then stand to the side. The Blackhawks lacked that physical presence in front of the net on the power play all year long until Shaw came along. Burnett has basically said that in his exit interview, he basically got the impression that they don't want him back. Maybe facing retirement. Jamal Mayers, Brendan Morrison came along in a trade. Don't expect him back. Sean O'Donnell, Sammy Lopesto, probably not neither of those guys coming back. O'Donnell for sure. And then Johnny Oduya came over in a trade. Probably not. Didn't have the greatest series against Phoenix. Don't really hear people beating the Johnny Oduya drum anymore. And then the guys, you know, I want to say this because – this really isn't a mea culpa, but before the season began, I picked the Blackhawks to go to the Stanley Cup Finals and play the New York Rangers, and I actually stuck with it basically out of stubbornness as we headed into the playoffs. But I did so with the thought that Stan Bowman was going to use the money along the way, was going to use the money that he saved trading Brian Campbell away. And that the final kind of guy that was brought in out from outside the organization, Rusty Olesh, who didn't work out at all, but they still have 2 more years of a very expensive contract to sort of figure out what they're going to do with. But they didn't end up doing anything with that. And that was something, and this is, I wish, I don't know because I wasn't there, But I wish the question would have been asked, and maybe it was, but by the media there on exit day, as it were, you know, Stan Bowman talked about after he traded Brian Campbell that they were going to have that added flexibility, and they didn't use that flexibility. And I don't expect a GM to stand up there, because Stan Bowman's not Brian Burke, and he won't give you that kind of an answer. I don't expect Stan Bowman to stand there and exalt himself for not using the money that he saved on Brian Campbell. But in the end, you traded away Troy Brower, and you really, you know, Troy Brower kind of made his own way with a bad playoff last year, but you missed him, and you didn't replace him. You didn't replace Brian Campbell, and that's going to be hard. And you didn't use that money for anything really, unless you want to say you did with Johnny Oduya. And there was, I mean, Dan Carcillo got hurt, but I mean, you weren't going to pay what Florida paid for Thomas Kopechke, but there was a certain kind of, kind of attitude and aggressiveness and a little jam that Kopechke brought when he was playing his best that you missed as well. So it's just like you wonder what they're trying to do, what they're trying to construct, because I'm not exactly sure. And they kind of lucked into this Andrew Shaw. I mean, really lucked into him. And it turned out to be that he was the missing piece, a part of the puzzle that, just sort of happened along, and it wasn't planned at all. And I just wonder, what is their plan? I mean, do we can we take anything out of Stan Bowman's comments postseason? And what is the plan? It's like, okay, we're not going to trade any of the core. All those guys are safe. So, okay, Patrick Sharp didn't have a good playoff. Dave Bullen didn't have a good playoff. You know, maybe you can excuse Jonathan Toews because of the injury. Patrick Kane didn't have a good playoff. It's like, okay, at what point, though, how many times do you have to, how many more years do you have to get bounced out early in the playoffs before you start looking at these guys and saying, well, maybe one of them is expendable if we can bring in a different element to this team. I don't know if there really is a plan other than we've got a really good team, and we're going to be in it every year.
I think, I'm writing a story for tomorrow, and basically that's one of the themes is, what is the plan? Is there an identifiable plan? Is there an identifiable style of play with this team? And I don't think so. I haven't thought so all year, really. Just to summarize very quickly for those that, may not be in tune with it or may have forgotten, three defensemen were signed over the summer. Not one of them was good at playing the special teams. Okay, so that's a hole. Kopechke, not the biggest fan of his at all, but he knew enough to be able to take a beating in front of the net, and he would even fall down at the right time and distract a goalie. Didn't replace him, didn't replace Brower at all, 200 hits or more and a few goals to go with it. No one liked that, really. And that's why the void was filled by Shaw when he came up, because he could hit and he did score. When Brunette was signed, I thought, well, I guess they're going to use him as a screen setter in front of the net, because there really isn't anybody else but Toews, and you don't want him there all the time. That was a swing and a miss, too. Didn't really make, and I know you said it from the very beginning, didn't make sense at all. And I didn't see a lot of sense in it either, especially after I saw, in fact, in person, how slow Brunette was, even slower than he looked on TV last year. So there were gaping holes. And, that gets back to, that's the general manager. And then you looked at a coach who seemed to be stubborn with what he was doing, playing John Scott, not playing Sammy Lapisto at all, sticking with the same people. On the power play, when Steve Monador went in the middle on the power play unit, and was trying to set a screen, I knew they were done. If it resulted in that, too many players trying to do something that they never were before, and they were veteran players. Monador trying to be some sort of an offensive spark plug on the power play. Mayer's being used at center all the time and on the power play. Brunette skating on a top line with guys that are, he looked like he was towing a boat compared to them. It just all was disjointed, and now I'm not sure where they go with it from here. you know, I think the first admission is that someone has to say, you know what, we made some mistakes. And then not to get a center, another center that could take draws for the penalty on a penalty kill beside Taves. I mean, all I kept hearing on this press conference was how they missed Dan Carcillo. And I'll admit, and I'm probably a bigger backer of Dan Carcillo than most, if he turns himself around whereby he can learn how to get along with referees and officials and maybe turn himself into kind of the way that Matt Cook did this year, maybe there's a real value to Dan Carcillo. Maybe he could score 10, 12 goals, maybe even 15 goals. If he could stay on the ice and be, you know, an agitator, maybe it does make sense to re-sign him and to put a lot on his back as far as being able to play as a top six forward, as an agitator and a gritty guy. Maybe that does make sense. But I saw, like, you know, there was a gaping hole once he left the lineup, and, you know, fingers are pointed that, you know, that really hurt us. In the meantime, I see a team that lacked a lot of things, and there's really nothing in place or no reference to trying to get better in certain areas.
I want to talk about the power play for a few minutes here with you, Al, because I think, you know, a lot of Stan Bowman's fueling it, you know, and Joe Quenneville didn't really, it was, you know, one of the other interesting comments, and I don't have it in front of me, but when asked about, you know, his assistant's job security, I mean, Joe Quenneville didn't really squash it, you know, as far as, you know, no, there's going to be no changes on his coaching staff. And you got Stan Bowman here basically saying that, you know, like, our coaches are the reason why our special teams are bad. So there's fuel there. And it, you would, just by what people are saying, you wonder about Mike Kitchen's job security. And I know that would appease a lot of fans that think they know what's going on in practice and who's to blame for the power play and everything. But, you know, Barry Smith had a lot of influence on that at the end of the year, too, and nothing changed. So, you know, the illustrious Barry Smith couldn't turn the power play around either. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to claim to know how much of it's coaching and how much of it's not. But I do want to say this. I think, this is just my opinion, I think there's a fundamental disconnect, or if you want to call it ignorance, about what power plays and how coaches and players approach power plays nowadays. You know, if you think about a penalty kill, okay, and this, you know, if someone asked me, like, what my suggestion would be, if you think about a penalty kill, how are penalty kills designed? You know, usually most teams have three sets of forwards on the PK, and you hope that those guys, each group of forwards, each group of two, is only going to be on the ice for 30 seconds. And they're going to go as fast as they can, as hard as they can for 30 seconds. They clear the puck, and then they get off the ice, and then you get a new two. On the power play side of it, what do you have? It's the five decades old attack of, we're going to have two groups of five, and each group gets 1 minute.
Hardly ever turns out to 1 minute apiece.
And what do? They go out there, they very methodically and slowly bring the puck up the ice, they try to set up in the zone, and then they work it around the perimeter, and then they try to get a shot on the net, and then you hope that your one guy, because boxes of four collapse now, you hope your one or two guy can beat three or four to the puck. I think there's a fundamental disconnect with that. I think that I would get away from groups of five, first of all. You know, that may be a hard thing to do early on in the season when you're looking at chemistry and if you made a lot of changes. I get away from groups of five. I'd send fresh bodies every chance I can get. I think power plays now don't outwork penalty kills, and I think that that's the problem. And it's a league-wide issue because the Blackhawks aren't the only team that has a hard time with their power play. I think that, you know, the way you switch this thing around, you turn this thing around, is your power play has to work harder than the penalty kill. Because as we've seen, who kills penalties now? The best players on every team kill penalties. So you have the best players on the other team playing as hard as they can for 30 seconds against your best players, who are basically standing stationary around the offensive zone. It doesn't work. And that's why I think that it needs to change. If your power play isn't outworking, I don't care if you got a 5-on-4 advantage. If your five aren't outworking four, it's not going to work.
Well, let me say this. I think there's a couple of fundamental – there's three fundamental things that need to happen for the power play to get better. The first thing is the shooting accuracy from the point has to be a lot better. Duncan Keith takes the majority of the shots, is on the ice the majority of the time. He has a 2.5% shooting percentage. Now, I know defensemen are lower, but comparatively speaking to his past years, that's a low shooting percentage. That's one. Two, you have to win faceoffs, because if you don't, you're wasting 20 seconds. That's another problem. If Taves isn't on the ice, they're not winning the faceoff for the most part. And three, all the better power plays have a guy who could stand in front of the net, who isn't afraid, who can not only screen the goalie effectively, which is an art in itself, but also could tip and deflect pucks in. The Hawks don't have anyone to do that, really. They have Shaw now. You know, I don't know if he's going to be their guy, but you know, he's a smaller player, and he did a nice job. So if you're missing those three things, it's very difficult to score. Plus, you have to be able to move the puck quickly and get shots on goal. The getting shots on goal was the failable part here. There weren't enough shots on goal. There aren't any secrets. You know, you're not going to be able to do the backdoor play to Sharp for 3 years in a row. I mean, you can't even do it for 3 weeks in a row. Everybody has video of everything. It's so much more difficult to score now on power plays. The defensemen, everyone isn't, except the Hawks forwards, everyone blocks shots, which is another problem with the penalty kill here, along with the fact of winning faceoffs. There's a lot of missing pieces here that prevent it. I don't care. Patrick Kane's the best perimeter player in the game. It doesn't matter if you don't have the other elements.
I think the other thing, you know, I want to move along and wrap up the power play here, but I think one of the most exciting plays, and this isn't happening near enough, and it's not just the Hawks, but with the way the game is supposed to be called now with stick penalties and infractions and holding and all that, one of the things that doesn't happen near enough and one of the most exciting plays that we see on the power play is when, you know, specifically, whether it's Taves, Hossa, or Kane, that hard drive off the half wall into the middle of the ice. You're not supposed to be able to be hooked and pulled down, so I don't understand why that doesn't happen more, because now you have one of your bodies moving to the net. In theory, you have one standing in front of the net, and maybe you have one on the goal line approaching there too. So now it's more of a three-on-three, as it were. Once you get that shot off, then the battle for the rebound. I think that doesn't happen near enough.
Well, who beside Taves goes to the net with the puck on the power play?
Well, Kane will do it, but it's usually from...
But he stops short and shoots.
Yeah, not lower than the hashes, of course.
Right. And, you know, that's another issue for the whole offense, too, is how many guys take the puck to the net. You know, turn the corner and take the puck to the net. A lot of players just don't want to do it because you get creamed. I mean, you're coming in and a weak side defenseman could come across and pop you. You know, Brian Bickle, that should be his claim to fame. That's his ticket for making big money in the NHL, is to be able to get to the net with the puck. Maybe that light bulb has finally gone off. He's in the last year of his contract. If he wants to be anything more than what he is now, he needs to show that. You know, with his size, that has to be part of his game. You know, it can't be 35-foot wrist shots. So we'll have to see how that works out, but that's another area to address also.
You bring up a guy, and I wanted to make this point. I've been thinking about this all day. I want to go back to something Stan Bowman said after, you know, in the postseason presser. He says, when you don't reach your goal, which is to win the Stanley Cup, it's a big disappointment. But I think you have to look at the whole season, not the ending. End quote, Stan Bowman. Brian Bickle. I think at a certain point, and I think we're at that point, what you see is what you get, and you have to stop hoping for more. And I would say that with Brian Bickle. Michael Frolik, it's not just in Chicago. It was the three seasons before in Florida. I think you have to stop hoping for those, in Michael Frolik or Brian Bickell, those moments of glory in the playoffs or those moments during the season where it's like, wow, if he could just do that all the time, it's not going to happen. Not in my view. And I don't know how you get rid of Michael Frolik's contract. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. But I think it's time to cut your losses on Brian Bickell. He's got an affordable contract. I'm sure there are a lot of teams that would love to have a guy with that contract on their team. I can't see going forward another season of waiting for Brian Bickell to get it. I think his time is done.
Well, it's the Jack Skilly syndrome, okay? And by that I mean you take a player who never was really a scorer at any level, a real dignified scorer. Now you get him in the NHL, and because you play him with elite players and because he seems to have some tools, all of a sudden he's going to score 25 or 30 goals. I mean, Brian Bickell scored 28 goals in 41 games. That was his best production ever. That was with the Ottawa 67s. Now I'm willing to bet a sizable amount of money that in 2005, Brian Bickell was just about as big as he is now. And if you can't dominate when you're playing in the Ontario Hockey League and you're as big as him to score goals, that's not your strong suit. Michael Frolik, there was a reason why he didn't score more than 20 goals in Florida. The reason the Hawks thought was because he wasn't with players that complimented him and would make him better. That's true sometimes. But many times you are what you are because in Florida he was on the first team power play. In Florida he played a lot of minutes. In Florida he was on there at crunch time when they needed to score. But he really wasn't able to become a bona fide goal scorer. Michael Frolik is a useful player. He's just not a useful player for the amount of money they're paying him. To me, the reason that they probably didn't get swept in the playoffs was because that line wound up playing well when he came back. When Shaw went out, although I'm not blaming Shaw, Frolik came in and the third line played about as well as they played since the first month of the season. But that's not saying Michael Frolik's going to score more than 8 or 10 goals a year. So once again, do we admit a mistake or do we still try to force feed someone into a role that they're probably not going to be able to fulfill? And, you know, you mentioned that's two players right there. You don't get hurt with Bickell's contract. But what's his role? I mean, is he just going to be a checking line player and score 8 or 10 goals a year, or is there more to be thought of him? And the same with Frolik. Just one of the many questions here that needs to be answered, and some of it I think is an admission that maybe there was something off target by what was thought these players were capable of doing.
I want to go over kind of the depth chart of what's left over, because I think you bring up Brian Bickell, whether or not he can be or whether going forward he'll be a checking line. I think, you know, and you brought up in the column that you wrote, your last column on Thursday night at MyFoxChicago.com, you're talking about the core, which we talk about a lot, maybe some people. I mean, the core, as identified, really is Taves, Kane, Sharp, Keith, Seabrook, Hossa, and Boland. Boland bringing up the rear in that equation. Now, if Boland is untouchable, and I want to get your thought on that in a minute, but if Boland is untouchable, then he's your third line center. I think the perfect guy to be on that line with him. And, you know, when he gets hot, you move him up. But Andrew Shaw and Dave Boland together would be one of the more irritating lines to play against in all of hockey, maybe the most, when Dave
right.
Boland is engaged in playing that way.
Right.
Like, that's finding the right guy to play with them, and in Dave Boland's history, when he plays well, it's having a skill guy to play with. He plays very well off guys that handle the puck well. I don't know that that's Victor Stahlberg. It probably isn't. But, you know, is it Brandon Saad? If Brandon Saad can make the Blackhawks, you know, is there another guy that they can go find? I don't know. But to me, Brian Bickell's not that guy. You know, Michael Frolik's not that guy, because as soon as you give Michael Frolik the puck, you know you're not getting it back. So, you know, and he doesn't score, not with any consistency. So, I mean, I think that those two guys together is great. I think the rest of the guys that are left over, I just want to glance over this. Taves, Stahlberg, Sharp, if you want to call that your first line. Now, what can, another thing, and you know, these two guys swear that there's not a disconnect, Joe Quenneville and Stan Bowman. But Stan Bowman talked about Patrick Kane like he's already the second line center moving forward. Joe Quenneville, not so sure. Joe Quenneville is the one that fills out the lineup card. So I don't know, but let's just call Patrick Kane your second line center. Marian Hossa in severe concussion. Hopefully he's going to be all right, but let's just say he's fine. So you got Kane, Hossa, and Carcillo. You got Bolin and Shaw, and then you've got Kruger as your fourth center. On the defense, you got Keith and Seabrook, Jalmerson, Letty, Olsen, and Monitor. Monitor's an interesting guy because Monitor came in on that front-loaded contract, $4.6 million up front. With, you know, next year he'll make 2.3. He's got cap-friendly 2.75, but I think that they were almost thinking that they'd get this year out of him, and then he'd be a guy to be movable. Well, now he's got the concussion. He's not movable. First of all, let's start with this. The core, and you talked about this a little bit, and you said it was very unlikely that any of those guys would move. Percentage-wise, or, you know, is there any chance that one of those guys goes this summer?
Any chance? I think there's more of a chance now than there ever was. But I think it's a slim chance. I think it's less than 20%.
How about Jalmerson?
Jalmerson's not in the core, but he makes the most sense if you're going to trade him. But here's the funny thing about this all. Jalmerson, for as much as people want to rag on him, you know, and if he was getting paid $2 million instead of $3.5 million or $1.5 million instead of $3.5 million, which he would have been getting paid closer to that amount if not for the offer sheet. But they might have re-signed him anyway to higher or to a more heavy contract since then. But people are always trying to say he doesn't justify the money. The fact of the matter is that there's no replacement for Jalmerson. Johnny Oduya isn't Jalmerson. So those that say, well, let's get rid of Jalmerson, trade him, supplant Johnny Oduya in that spot for about the same amount of money, that means that you'd have to go and find another defenseman, which you could, a third-pairing defenseman probably, because you're going to want Oduya to play the number four probably with Letty, I guess. But they're different players. Jalmerson, the Hawks don't block enough shots. Seabrook and Jalmerson are the only ones that block shots. So Jalmerson's the only one of the group that you could trust really on the penalty kill. Interestingly enough, Johnny Oduya never really was a 5-on-4 player or someone that was really thought of being a deluxe penalty kill. But when he came here, he was doing everything so well that, you know, that flew too. Maybe water found its level, as they say, you know, later on in the playoffs, and he became the player that he's been for most of his career, which is someone that you could get by with, who could be a nice, you know, 12 to 15-minute player on a not-so-good team, maybe a number four, on a really good team, maybe a number five, somewhere in there. Very similar to a Steve Monitor. So if you trade Jalmerson, there's a hole there. Most people now think that Bolin's expendable because they think Kruger could go in and step in for him. Kruger's got a lot of things going for him, but until he can last more than 3 or 4 weeks without getting, you know, a concussion or being out of the lineup, if you think Bolin is injury prone, well, this kid, I don't recall seeing many players get hit the way Kruger does. And as smart as he is and as aware as he is with his game savvy and his ability and his vision and things like that and his sense to play both sides of the puck, he leaves himself wide open and he gets clobbered. And I said today over on Hockey Buzz in a comment, I said, when he comes over the boards, I start to wince. Because you just feel like he's going to get creamed, and he does. So I don't know how he stays healthy trying to play against bigger centers, 18, 20 minutes a night. So Bolin, you'll get something for Dave Bolin. What are you going to do with the money if you were to trade him? Would you go and go and try to get a second line center then? Or would you go and look for a left wing? There's a hole there too. So the way that came about with that core, I got that bit of info because everybody thought the Hawks were going to trade Patrick Sharp or Dave Bolin. Very few around the NHL thought that there was any chance the Hawks would give up on a Stanley Cup winning goalie and not re-sign Niemi. Once Johmerson got the offer sheet, the word around was Sharp was going to be traded. If you recall, Stan Bowman called a press conference right before Sharp's wedding that summer to announce he wasn't getting traded. There was a reason for that, because the rumors were strong and persistent that he was going to be dealt. And actually, they also said in towards the beginning of the summer that Bolin was one of the guys that was going to be kept, and everybody else was going to be gone. When the offer sheet came, that stopped them from keeping either Andrew Ladd or Niemi, in my opinion. So that's your core guys. I don't think there's if a 20% chance, maybe. It would be ironic to trade Patrick Sharp now after, you know, you had the world after him the year the Hawks won the Cup. He had a year left on his contract, a more reasonable cap hit. He could have been dealt, and they didn't do it. Now you look at, he's a $5.9 million cap hit for the next 5 years, the wrong side of 30 years old. His trade value isn't up from that point. And in a lot of ways, the organization values him because he's a different type of player. So of the core players that I identified, those seven untouchable players, Bolin would seem the most likely to go, if anybody, but I think it's less than a 20% chance that that would happen. I think for one of them to go, or for like a Bolin to go, it wouldn't just be Bolin. It'd have to be a pretty good shuffle. Like, it would have to be, for it to make sense, you'd have to get rid of a Bolin, a Jalmerson, a Stahlberg, a big trade, and then look to fine-tune things, open up some cap space with Bolin and Jalmerson leaving. That's almost $7 million. Replace them. Maybe Kruger slides up. Then you could look to save some money on Bolin. The same thing with Jalmerson. If you don't identify him as being a future top four guy, remember he slid down and played third pairing minutes sometime, maybe they would look to save some money that way and to retool. But I'm almost thinking for one of the seven to be traded, it's going to have to be a summer where that's not the only deal. There's going to be a couple of big deals. If Stahlberg is not going to be used as a top six forward and get power play time, in my view, you trade him now. Because if he starts out decently, and if Quenneville plays him the minutes, which he didn't do until the later part of the year, but if he plays 16, 18 minutes a night, and he starts to score and produce, they're going to wind up having to get rid of him at the trade deadline if they're out of it, or they'll be trading him right after the season's over for a third-round pick, because they're not going to want to re-sign him for $3 million because he hasn't been identified as a top-six forward. So it's either one or the other. Either develop the kid to be a top-six forward or sell now while he's high, while the value is high, and look for a team to take a shot on him because he's cheap, and maybe you could pick up someone who's a more veteran-like player, maybe you get a draft pick or something along with it, because Stahlberg is very inexpensive and he has a lot of upside.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of points. Patrick Sharp, I think, with Kane potentially, probably moving to center. And, of course, Bowman also said he didn't understand why people all year long were talking about the second-line center, and he, you know, himself wants to move Patrick Kane permanently to center. Whatever. But if that does happen, and, of course, you have this uncertainty now about the health and the future of Marian Hossa, if, in my view, that makes Patrick Sharp untouchable. Because that's the one winger now that you for sure have left that you can count on.
I mean, that could score 30 goals or so. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, that's a lot of production to go. You know, forget about what he's going to get paid. There's still a lot of production to go. Now, the interesting thing is, and I'm sorry to jump over you here, the interesting thing is if Marian Hossa doesn't play. Now, I hope to God that he doesn't have any lasting physical effects from that concussion, whiplash, whatever he got. But if he decides to say, you know what, I don't want to take the chance anymore, I'm calling it a day, that leaves $5 million in cap space. Now they could go take a swing at Parisi or even Suter. That creates a whole different type of look here. That makes the summer really interesting. So I don't think it's 100% sure that Hossa's going to come back. You hear different things. John Jackal over at Hockey Buzz wrote about it a couple times that he heard, rumblings that he's considering not coming back, and he has to evaluate his condition, and that makes sense. I don't know if anybody's had any back or neck problems or disc problems or spine problems, but if you go and talk to an orthopedic surgeon and you do have that, or a neurosurgeon, chances are they're going to scare the life out of you because you're dealing with your spinal cord, and there's not a lot of room for error. So it wouldn't surprise me if, they had a sit-down with him and they told him maybe about some risks, maybe about some possibilities, maybe what he's looking at is maybe, a prolonged type of, maybe there's neurological damage or things that would take him a long time to get over. No one really knows. But that would make it into a really interesting summer. But once again, when would that be happening? Would it happen in enough time so that the Hawks could get involved with things? And then you have the CBA deal brewing too. So a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, I want to talk about Nicholas Hjalmarsson, and I'll save it for next week with Sam Fels because I want to get more kind of in depth into Hjalmarsson. I got more of a take on that. But you started to bring up names and it's a lot of, Marian Hossa doesn't have to just say, and I know you know this, but I want to make this point. Marian Hossa doesn't have to make a decision. I mean, there's nothing, he's young enough that there's nothing forcing him to make a decision. He could just say, we could get to, and I don't think that he could make this decision by July 1. So I think, but he could get into September and say, you know what, I don't know that I'm going to play this year. That could happen.
Or I don't see myself coming back before the holidays.
Right. And you have to adjust. I do want to say this. You bring up some names. There's one name, and I was going off of your, if the Blackhawks open up a little bit more. They don't have to move. They have cap room as it is. And, again, we don't know what's going to happen. I don't think that the cap is going to go, is going to go any lower, too much lower than it is now, and we keep hearing that it'll be a rollback. But if there's one name out there, Stan Bowman, talking so much about the power play, focusing on the power play, focusing on something else I want to talk about in a second. If there's one guy that, I don't think you can get into the Ryan, it just doesn't seem fathomable to be you can get in the Ryan Suter sweepstakes. And there are other guys out there, Matt Carl, Brad Stewart, Dennis Wideman, guys like that. Those guys don't excite me. If there's one guy that's out there who's young, who's big, and you could really stick it to somebody while you're doing it, while you improve your power play, while you improve your second pair, he's on the Florida Panthers, and he's Jason Garrison. That enormous bomb of a shot that he has from the point. He's a decent defenseman. He's big. He battles in front of his net. He's not perfect. He's not a great defenseman. But that's a guy that you can get him. He's not going to go for six or seven, but you can get him, and he would solve some of your problem on that power play.
I agree 100%, but he's going to be sought after. He's almost in a position where he's going to have his pick, I think. Whether that pick means he's going to get $2.5 million or $2 million or whatever, he's not going to be outrageous, but I think he's going to have some choices. And I think, interestingly enough, depending on the Panthers situation, they have other players down there that need to be re-signed and are going to get raises too, Versteeg being one of them. So I don't know how much money they'll have available to really get into a high-stakes bidding war with anyone. He's definitely one guy that would help a lot and would help fix the power play, no doubt. You're going to have to see how aggressive Stan Bowman is. I mean, first he's got to be aggressive. I mean, when you look at it, if they went after Ryan Suter, it would almost be as if Brian Campbell was traded for nothing, a year was wasted, and then they went after Ryan Suter, who's going to make Campbell-like money for a similar deal. It would be odd, okay? I'm not saying it can't happen. I don't see it happening unless there's another bigger trade that comes down the road where there's more cap space open. But basically, Ryan Suter would put them in the same position they were in with Campbell, because he's going to get $6.5-7 million a year, 5 to 7 years. He's the top tick defenseman by far, just like Campbell was when he came out in that UFA year. So, you know, if you looked at, if Hossa were to say, you know, 3 weeks from now, I've had it, I'm not going to come back, this is it, well, then you better be all in on Zach Parise, because he plays the position you need. He's a left winger. Kane could go back and play right wing, or they could figure something out, or maybe they'd leave him at center, I don't know. But that seems to me that would be the guy that you'd go in all in on if by chance somehow that money would be opened up with Hossa. If not, there are other players out there, Gregory Campbell, players like that, that aren't going to be very, very heavy contracts. They're going to get raises from what they were making now, but they're going to be sought after. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, like I was saying, I was talking to somebody earlier this year. We were talking about July 1 and sort of like what's going to happen, because if you don't, you know, and the GMs will have inside information about where the talks are heading and everything, but they won't know. I mean, I don't think anybody expects there to be a deal in place by July 1, so they won't know. And so everybody knows that the existing CBA doesn't run out until September 15th, just prior to when camps would open. So we're running on the current system until September 15th. It's just like these guys are out there, but who, you know, aside from the lower level teams that have cap space and are going to be willing, those of who will be willing to spend money, I mean, are the higher end players, or maybe sort of your middle of the road guys, you know, I mean, the guys that are out there, Alexander Semin, Zach Parise, Shane Doan, Paul Gostad, Ole Jokinen, and Travis Moan, those are the names. Are those guys going to say, well, I don't really want to sign with Columbus, I don't want to sign with Florida, or, you know, these other, I'm going to wait and see how, I mean, does that happen? I mean, no, we don't know. So I, you know,
well, let me say this, I might be all wrong on this, but here's what I think. I think that at some point, you know, and Gary Bettman said, well, just do business as usual. He already said that, just do business as usual. You know, you don't know for sure how much to spend, but just do business as usual. I think somehow, some way, there has to be an understanding at some point before we get too late into the summer. You know, people keep saying that the cap could go down. Well, if they screw this up, the game in many ways has never been more popular, from participation at the youth levels, attendance, and TV ratings. At some point, players have to say, you know, they're getting paid now. So I think, you know, and the baseball comparisons keep coming all the time with fear. The difference here, I think, compared to baseball in the 80s or so, is in the NHL is a lot of haves and have-nots. You go up and down the roster, and, you know, you look at the players that make over $3.5 million, and there's quite a few more that aren't making that much money. You know, the Blackhawks have about the same amount, but a lot of teams aren't that way. And even if it's the same amount of players, that, let's just say you have 12 players that are making over $3.5 million or $4 million, and you have 10 or 11 players that aren't, everybody gets the same vote. So when you lose, you know, talking about losing years or whatever, getting to the extremes, every player has the same vote. They don't get more votes because they're making more money. It's not like, you know, owning shares of stock. They all get one vote. So that's something to keep in mind. The other thing is that people are talking about a rollback on the cap. The cap could go up to about $72 million if the players take their 5%, what they call it, multiplier, right? And they have every year that they have the chance to take it since the lockout. They've taken it. So I think the cap could go to close to $73 million. What if they just had a rollback whereby they said it's going to be the same? We're going to assure everyone that it's the same as last year. That gives them a couple of ways to swing. Some could say, well, they rolled it back. They stopped it from going up because it's really $8 million or $7 million less than it could have been. And GMs will have an idea in mind of where they're at. I can't see it being less than it was this year. And I could also, I really can't see when the dust settles that the big market teams are going to get screwed on contracts that they're hung on. So there's going to have to either be some kind of amnesty going forward on contracts. You just can't change the game that much and crucify the teams that have basically been the lifeblood of the year, supporting the weak sisters and who have the heaviest payrolls. To me, that's illogical.
I want to hit a couple of things that I teased on the website before we actually talk about them before we go. First of all, I mentioned Philip Deneau earlier. Got a chance to watch Philip Deneau up close and personal a few times out in Rockford when he was recalled towards the end of the season. Of course, he has an NHL contract now. 19 years old. So he is basically in a situation where, just like Mark McNeil, where he has to make the Blackhawks in September, October, or he's going back to junior. If, with the exception of Brandon Saad, who I also understand is not, I mean, he's not necessarily a lock, like I think a lot of people think, to make the Blackhawks out of camp next year. Hearing his name associated with Rockford for next year. So, I mean, but that's up to Saad. But I think if there's a guy that I've seen play out of all these guys, and that includes Brandon Peary, Jeremy Moore, all these guys, if there's a guy who's really close, it's Philip Deneau. And Philip Deneau is a guy, and we talked about Dave Bolin. I don't know if I'm in Stan Bowman's shoes that I'm volunteering to trade Dave Bolin this summer, but going forward, that third line center spot is Philip Deneau's. And I mean, I've used this comparison on Twitter, and I'll say it here. When I watch Philip Deneau play, the offensive side of the game, it's not a fair comparison. But when I watch Philip Deneau, he reminds me of Jonathan Toews, just the way he hunts the puck. I mean, he is relentless. He is a dirty player to play against. He's determined. His legs are constantly moving. He has a nose for the puck. He's always around the puck. And yet, the offensive end of the ice, he's not going to be a first-line center anywhere at any point in his career, but he is your third-line center. You know, maybe not this year, although I would not rule it out. I would not rule it out. He would be, you know, the second-line center in Rockford, and you know, he was getting first-line minutes with Brandon Peary on the left-hand side 4 games into his AHL career. He's really close. Mark McNeil, not a shot. Not a shot. He can't keep up in Rockford. But so unless he has a miraculous summer where he makes improvements leap by leaps and bounds, he's just too slow at this point.
But Deneau could play, has to play either in the NHL or go back to juniors.
Right. But I mean,
yeah, that's the rub, though.
I'm telling you, Al, though, I mean, he is close. I mean,
what I'm saying is that if he's that close, then you take the shot, then you would trade Dave Bolin. If what you're saying is, you know, they follow that line of thinking, because you'd go and say, okay, instead of in a perfect world, Deneau would play in Rockford and be called up in February. Let's say that it's not a perfect world, so he has to make the Hawks roster. That gives you an opportunity to trade a Dave Bolin to someone, and his value would be higher because there's cost certainty on his deal. He has 2 years left at 3.375 as far as a cap hit. Now, if you don't do that this year and you wait to next year, you don't get as much, because anyone taking him knows that he's a UFA then in 14-15. Similar to situation as Sharp was in a few years ago, when they could have dealt him while he had another year or so left on his contract, actually 2 years. So that's an interesting dilemma.
I also want to bring up, again, right before we go, we talked about this a little bit earlier on, but, you know, you expected it. You talked about it on this show here with me, that you expected them to come back with the same goaltending tandem, Corey Crawford and Ray Emery, going into next season. I want to go back. After Game 5, when Joe Quenneville was asked who his goaltender was, or if there'd be basically consideration to going to Ray Emery for Game 6, Joe Quenneville left it up in the air. Now, what do we know about Joe Quenneville? During the regular season, when he left it dangling like that, 9 times out of 10, he made the switch.
Mm-hmm.
When it counted, when it meant something, when it meant everything, Game 6, after basically throwing Corey Crawford under the bus to the media after Game 5, he went back to Corey Crawford. That says something to me about his confidence in Ray Emery. That says something to me going forward about his goaltending. That he, I ask you this, Al. Do the Blackhawks need, now they have Corey Crawford, they have Ray Emery coming back, Carter Hutton is an RFA and he'll be brought back. Alexander Salak will play hockey somewhere, but he's not going to make $600,000 to back up Carter Hutton and Rockford. Do the Blackhawks need to upgrade their goaltending?
Well, I mean, you can certainly make the case that they need to upgrade their goaltending. I think Emery, let's start with him quickly. He was a safe choice to do that, and evidently, there was some trepidation there by Stan Bowman thinking that he was going to be offered, a 2-year deal or something with close to $2 million a year. I don't see it. I mean, I didn't see it, but I guess they figure that it's a tolerable amount of money. I guess he signed for about $1.2 million or $1.3 million, and it's something that they could swallow if things don't work out, and they thought it wasn't worth the chance to go into the off season, whereby someone would have tried to get him. I see a lot of goaltenders changing uniforms, and to me, he signed for $1.15 million as his cap hit next year. To me, Ray Emery wouldn't be near the head of the class in interest for goaltenders. So that was kind of interesting. Corey Crawford, unless they change the model here, unless they break from the Scotty Bowman Detroit Red Wing model and go out to try to sign someone for $4 or $5 million, I think that they're going to go back with Crawford and Emery. Maybe Hutton somehow sneaks in there somehow, some way. I thought Emery would have gotten the last start originally, but I think he probably did the right thing going back to Crawford. I think they're going to stick it out with those two and see what happens, and hopefully Crawford rebounds.
I think he did the right thing with Crawford. My concern going forward, we know that, listen, Joe Quenneville's a great coach about a lot of things, and there's things that annoy people, but you know what? A lot of coaches switch up the lines constantly. That's going on because coaching is becoming very uniform, and there's very few ways for coaches in the course of a game to have an effect on the outcome, and that's the major one, is to change up the lines. My problem with Joe Quenneville is that he treats his goaltenders like third-line forwards in fifth and 6D, and you can't do that, and he's made that mistake countless times. My concern for Corey Crawford, and I like Corey Crawford, and he should have went to him in Game 6, and he should be the number one guy going forward. My concern would be this. It's in Corey Crawford's head now that he had a bad season and that he needs to be better. So there's a possibility there that he's going to make adjustments, that he's going to try to make changes to, whether they're mental, whether they're, fundamental, in the way he approaches the goaltending position. And if he struggles with those changes early on next year, what has happened every year that a goaltender has struggled early under Joe Quenneville? He loses confidence in him and he never regains it. And if that happens next year and Ray Emery is the guy left, how does that turn out?
You have to sleep with one eye open, I guess, and hopefully Emery could play, 55 or 60 games or whatever, or 50 games. I don't know if that's possible even. I don't know what it would come to. Let's put it this way, though. Corey Crawford never had a job handed to him before, really, at the NHL level until this year. And it didn't turn out so well. Maybe he's better under pressure. Maybe he's better under pressure. He was the chosen one, really, with the organization from everything that I've heard. He's, a pupil of Stefan Waite. Those two are supposed to be, they work well together. They have a long history. Maybe they get things back in order this summer. The Hawks are going to hope that he rebounds, much like Jimmy Howard did in his second year after stumbling, or in his third year, rather, after stumbling in his second year. They're going to hope for that to happen. And unless you're, you know, unless they're going to break from their model and somehow throw more money at the position, I think they're going to stick with Crawford. Maybe they have their eyes overseas for possibly someone, you know, to come out of nowhere, kind of like an Antti Niemi did at some point. I think they're going to be aware of that also. But I think for the most part, unless there's a big shakeup here, it'll be Crawford and Emery to start the year. And if not Crawford and Emery, Crawford and Hutton, with Emery maybe going somewhere else, if it turns out Hutton really outplays him in camp, and after the first 2 months of the season or so, he does well in Rockford, maybe they make a move that way. Otherwise, I think that they're going to have to go with Crawford, and you're going to have to hold your breath that he does rebound.
All right, Al, I want to thank you again very much for doing the show. It's always a pleasure. We always have a great time here on the podcast.
Yes, it's always a good time, and it's going to be an interesting summer, and hopefully there'll be some things to talk about and some things to look forward to come the fall.
I'm sure there'll be plenty, and we'll have you back on the show to do it again here with me. And next week, I just want to make mention again, Sam Fells, the Committed Indian, SecondCityHockey.com, and everywhere else you could find Sam Fells. We're going to have him here on the show next week to talk about a lot of the stuff we did tonight and a whole ton more. And again, Al Simaglia, MyFoxChicago.com, SiriusXM Radio, and also HockeyIndependent.com. Thanks again, Al. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Good night, everybody. And let's see if this works. There we go. Good night, everybody.
And then I gave it all away. It's not the world that's heavy, it's just the things that you save. And I'm drifting, drifting away. Drifting, drifting, drifting along. I rid myself of worries and my worries were gone. I only run when I want to and I sleep like a dog. I'm drifting, drifting along. But never fall long. I sometimes wonder if they know that I'm gone. I'm drifting, drifting along. Drifting, drifting along. Oh, drifting, drifting
along. Johnny always says you can just screw so much and drink so much.
Let's get fucking like a monkey.